Hi, Nadia.
Hey, Catherine.
I might ask you to take over halfway through so that I can eat lunch because I have to leave like when we're done for a doctor's appointment.
Yeah, no problem. I think this one will be a little bit more clear on the if we choose to write it up. Because we have that text in the beginning and we have links to the documents that we're talking about. And it just seems like it'll work better as like a readable case study.
Okay, well,
We'll
we can
see.
see how
But
it goes.
yeah, so either way I'm recording it and we can.
Let me text Emmanuel.
Yeah, I just sent him a link again with the link.
He is habitually late for conference calls.
Oh, that's okay. I was out most of yesterday, so I did my citizenship oath yesterday.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I thought it was just going to be like, an hour. It took such a long time.
How long did it take?
So we were supposed to be there at 8, but the doors only opened at 8, so I got there at like 7:45, thinking, they probably do like batches at a time. But the line was like a whole block, like encircling the whole building. And even when I got there at 7:45, like the line, I was like almost at the back of the line, and there's still people coming. So it didn't start until 9:45, and then you
Was
have
it
to like
cold? Were
stand.
you waiting out in the cold?
Yeah, it was cold. It was cold. But luckily, I mean, it's not.
Oh,
It's
Emmanuel's
cold
on.
here. Okay, excellent.
Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi, Catherine.
Thank you for
Hi.
joining.
No, you're welcome. How are you? Hi, Nadia.
It's very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
No, it's okay. It's my pleasure.
Nadia, do you want to say a few words about what it is that we're doing?
Sure. So under the CASPER project, Catherine and I have been working to develop a course for advocates and for journalists to help them to understand to understand really what mathematical modeling is and how they can use it or make use of work that's already been done in their own advocacy efforts and the way that they communicate as journalists. So we actually started off last year with a four-part webinar series and have turned that into an online course that will be starting with its first cohort sometime in early 2020. So as part of this course, we wanted to highlight a couple of case studies where there's been some really real concrete evidence of how mathematical modeling has been used, either for a particular advocacy effort or for a particular intervention. And so we've lined up about three or four different interviews, and yours is just one of several. And so we really appreciate having you take the time to speak with us. And if you'd like to see the final product of the course, then let us know, and we can, once everything is online, we can send you a link as well, so you can see how what you're doing, this interview, fits into everything as a whole.
Oh, thank you for the background, and definitely it will be great to see how the course looks like when it's done. Advocacy and the work with journalists, I think, is something that is very important. Not often we pay attention to that, but it's great to see that you guys are actually focusing on that particular aspect of a program.
Great, thanks. Before we get started, we have a short bio for you that I think Nadia got from somewhere online, but it needs to be updated. So maybe can we just take a second to go through this? So it currently says Dr. Emmanuel Gemelli served as the Senior Biomedical Prevention Advisor at the Office of HIV/AIDS at USAID for 9 years. He has been the VMMC technical lead for USAID, providing support to PEPFAR programs in Eastern and Southern Africa for the introduction and acceleration of the scale up of the VMMC program currently, blah, blah, blah. So what do you want us to have there? Should we keep that language, or is there anything you want us to add? And what should we say that you're doing now?
Given that the interview is related to what I was doing at USAID, I think the language is probably good to keep, but maybe just use the past that I wrote.
It's in past tense.
Yes.
But do you want to say anything about what you're doing now?
Well, what I'm doing now, I'm providing technical support, technical assistance to various organizations, for them to actually have the capacity to implement HIV programs and receive grants and manage them according to the standard. But between what I'm doing now and what I was doing at that time, maybe the link is not straightforward. You see what I mean?
So currently he is working as an independent consultant providing technical assistance to organizations to enhance their capacity to implement HIV/AIDS programs.
Yes.
Okay, I got that. So let me just save this before I forget. I'll send this to you.
Nadia, you can also look at my LinkedIn profile.
Okay.
Okay, great. So I just got your text saying that you're going to be on the call. Thanks. All right. So let's go ahead and start with the interview. So you've spent over 10 years working to scale up VMMC for HIV prevention in Southern and Eastern Africa. How did the initial DMPPT modeling influence the initial scale of VMMC in the 14 priority countries? So that was the first version of the model that was made back in 2009 or something like that. How did that model influence the initial scale up of VMMC in the 14 priority countries?
Yes, so maybe to understand is important to give a very short background. In 2007, WHO and UNAID issued recommendations for countries in Eastern and Southern Africa to introduce VMMC as part of the HIV prevention portfolio. And those countries were selected because they had low male circumcision prevalence and high HIV prevalence. And the recommendation came as the result of three randomized controlled trials that shows the protective effect of male circumcision for HIV prevention and for other diseases, actually. However, between 2007, when the recommendation was made, and 2010-11, the pace of countries actually embracing VMMC, introducing it and piloting and moving for scale up was a little bit slow. Because between the evidence and the decision to actually scale up, there are several questions that stakeholders have that the randomized controlled trial, unfortunately, cannot provide an answer, or even other research studies also are not well positioned to provide that answer. Some of those questions were, how much is it going to cost to actually introduce VMMC and scale it up? What is actually the added benefit of adding this new intervention compared to what we are already doing? Do we need to prioritize VMMC and deprioritize another intervention? Do we need to do them together? What is really the mix of funding allocation that we need to consider in this exercise of thinking of how to introduce VMMC? And what is even the volume that we are talking about? How many men will you have to circumcise? Where? And what will be the cost saving? So those questions were triggering stakeholders' mind and were holding many to make the necessary decisions to actually support, fully support the scale up of VMMC. Everyone was convinced about the evidence. Everyone was convinced that VMMC have a protective effect, but you still needed to have those questions answers for a full support from all stakeholders to move on. The DMPPT1 was actually designed to answer many of those questions. So what we did, we did a DEX review of all 14 countries using the DMPPT1, but we did not actually use the process of just doing that in our corner. We actually involved many stakeholders at the global level and also few stakeholders at country level in all of the 14 countries. We were able to discuss with them the questions of interest. We were able to discuss with them and validate the data that will be needed and also the various assumptions that were used in the DEX review. So when the result of the DEX review then came out, it was able to provide some clarity in terms of potential cost, in terms of potential cost savings, in terms of future infection averted as a result of the scale-up of the intervention. And it was also able to answer the question about if we don't scale up VMMC, what is it that we are losing? What is the proportion of HIV infection that VMMC alone will avert versus other interventions? So with the answer to those questions, most stakeholders then realized that it would be a huge missed opportunity not to scale up VMMC. So the decision by countries and donors to fully support VMMC that led to the launch by WHO and UNAIDS in December 2011 of the Joint Action Framework to Scale Up VMMC was actually came mainly as the result of those data. It was not the only element, but certainly the answer to those questions was very important and was really a catalytic in those conversations, because they were no longer question marks and everyone was able to speak on the same voice about those data. And everyone were then being able to focus on discussing how, when, what are we actually going to do tomorrow instead of should we. So that's the importance that the DNPPT1 actually took in influencing the initial scale-up of VMMC. So starting in 2012, VMMC became an intervention that was extremely well-funded, extremely well-supported by all stakeholders at global, at country level, and everyone was focusing with a clear goal of scaling up the intervention at all regions, provinces, districts where we had a low HIV, low MACE concern prevalence and high HIV prevalence.
That was such a beautiful overview. Thank you so much, Emmanuel. I think you've touched on a lot of the questions that we had, but just for the sake of clarity for our course participants, can you highlight some of the key messages that came out of the DNPPT1 modeling, and how were these messages actually communicated?
Yes, and maybe before I summarize the messages, and am I missing some of them, because I wanted to go back and read again those talking points we had, but I did not have time to do that. But maybe before I highlight some of those key messages, let me give a little bit background about how we came up with a consensus on the key messages. The DEX review we generated huge amount of data. And again, there, we were very careful to make sure that we work with all the stakeholders with the same understanding of the important questions of interest, and also that we discuss the interpretation of the data, the limitations of the data, that we all agreed on that, and we all come together to a same understanding of the key messages. And I'm saying that because until today, it struck me how people continue to use those key messages with the same intensity, exactly the same language that we put on at that time. And it probably come as a result of everyone being so comfortable in agreement with those messages. So one of the messages was the cost. We were able to estimate the volume of men that need to be circumcised per country, and in each country, per provinces of regions, and we were able to estimate how much that is going to cost. So that was then easy for donors and countries to understand what will be the level of resources that we are talking about and make commitment. We were also able to provide a clear message about the cost savings, which was estimated as savings of those who would have become HIV positive if they were not circumcised, the savings made by them not being on ARV. So that cost saving was estimated, and the difference between the cost and the cost saving was extremely convincing for decision makers to say, here, this is a very good investment. We definitely need to invest that dollar because we see the return of investment that is very clear. We were also able to estimate the number of infection averted, and that was a very powerful message. I remember that at that time it was estimated in some countries that we needed just to circumcise 4 men in order to avert 1 single HIV infection. When you bring down a message to a level that is so clear, everyone understand it, whether they are scientific or not, the decision become very clear, and everyone was then on the same page about the importance of VMMC in the with the potential of averting new HIV infection in the future. We were also able to estimate how important VMMC is vis-a-vis other prevention intervention. I remember that in Zimbabwe, for example, data were showing that it was impossible for the country to actually have, today people talk about epidemic control, to actually have something close to epidemic control without scaling up VMMC. So when the data and everyone agreed on a message like that, it's very clear what the decision makers need to do. Everyone understand that, oh, if we have $10 million currently on HIV prevention, and if there's one intervention that is actually critical for us to achieve our goal and objective in the next 15, 20 years, and that intervention is not being considered, we definitely need to reprioritize. So then at that point, the deprioritization discussion became something that was not dramatic at all. Resources was mobilized really overnight because everyone was very happy of making those necessary decisions at all levels to mobilize resources to support the VMMC as an intervention. So those are just some of the key messages that came from that modeling exercise, and that was used at that time by stakeholders to make decisions.
Thanks, Emmanuel. And I really want to highlight what you said at the beginning of your answer to this question for our participants, which is that one of the things that made this modeling exercise successful in influencing policy was that there was an entire process engaging stakeholders to understand the modeling, understand its limitations, and understand what the implications of the modeling were for the policy decisions. And that's something that doesn't always happen with modeling exercises, but it's crucial for modeling exercises to actually influence policy.
Yeah, that's very true.
So can you expand a little bit, Emmanuel, about the ways in which this modeling exercise was actually used in advocacy? What were the processes that were used to kind of disseminate these key messages that you just mentioned?
Well, we took a very comprehensive approach, and we first identified all the various channels of communications. We identified all the stakeholders that were very influential and very powerful. And knowing that those who are influential will definitely have to provide their input to those who have the power and authorities to make decisions. So what we did, we actually involved them in the process of doing the desk review and coming to conclusion of the key messages. By doing that, it was then easy when the messages came out, and then most organizations were, or countries were receiving that, they were not a questioning of the methodology of the limitations, because internally, everyone was fully aware of those already, and everyone was already expecting the result. So we took an approach that was participative, that was, we had a very intensive and strategic stakeholder engagement, and it started with that careful identification of stakeholder. I remember that we were having calls, separate calls with every single of the 14 countries, and in each of the 14 countries, it took a lot of time to bring together the key and necessary stakeholders together and have those calls. But when everyone was together, I don't remember a single stakeholder missing a single call. And it was very intensive, and it was frequent calls, and we were discussing every single number and every single stakeholder voice was heard in how we were actually summarizing and concluding on whatever we were doing. So that was the first approach that probably helped in the dissemination of the result. But then when the result, everyone was on the same page, the result came out, we worked with WHO and UNAIDS, and the result was published also in a scientific journal, PLOS Medicine, actually accepted to publish a collection. By doing so, it gave another level of credibility to the data by moving that exercise to a level of actually evidence. So the publication of those data in the scientific journal really moved the scientific, the HIV community to say, okay, these are new evidence. What is it that we have to do given this new evidence? The data was also disseminated internally to key global organizations within PEPFAR, USAID, CDC, Department of Defense, State Department, within WHO, UNAIDS, UNICEF, within the Gates Foundation, the World Bank. All of those organizations had their point of contact that was part of the exercise, and they were doing an internal job to actually also disseminate the data. And using the opportunity of conferences, particularly the ICASA conference in December 2011, several presentations and panel was put together to actually present the data to the broader HIV community and explain the data to them. At country level, several presentations was also made to key stakeholders, either on one-on-one, depending on the importance and the level of influence and level of power of those stakeholders. The data was presented at almost all levels, at the site level to implementing partners, to Ministry of Health, to Ministry of Finance, and to other influential stakeholders in each of those countries. We did not really left out a single opportunity that we were seeing that we can use to be able to disseminate the data. Every single opportunity that was in front of us, we were just using it to the full extent possible and to be able to disseminate the data.
That's great, thank you. That was very comprehensive, thank you. So what were some of the challenges or issues that you saw with the VMMC advocacy efforts that used the modeling data?
Well, the key challenge for us, we did not have challenges in terms of people being skeptical because, like I said, we were very careful on moving with everyone at the same pace. And I think that's probably a best practice and a probably what also guaranteed the success of that advocacy. However, engaging stakeholders, when you try to do it right, it becomes very time intensive and time consuming. So for an intervention like this that you want to introduce and bring to scale in several countries, definitely is important to consider carefully the stakeholder engagement, to be very strategic on how we do that. We did a very careful stakeholder engagement planification. And when you do that, then you have to take the necessary time that it takes to speak to people and to talk. So that is the challenge. It takes time to sit with someone and convince the person to understand the interests of the person and to try to address the concern that the person have in order for the person to become a supporter and influence positively decisions that will actually help to create an enabling environment. But I, looking back again, I think at that time we were a very solid and very solid team working to move forward the agenda of VMMC. We were talking almost on daily basis between all the various organizations at global level. It was not really the work of one person, but it was mainly a team of dedicated people pushing the agenda at various levels at the same time with the same vision and objective. So maybe because we had that kind of team spirit, we did not experience a lot of challenges. For us, the challenge was really the amount of time that we took to put into that advocacy.
Great, thanks. Now we're going to transition to talking about the next generation model. Can you tell us about what actually inspired the development of the DMPPT2?
Well, when the first part of the advocacy and the pushing for people to actually not accept, because VMMC was already accepted, but to actually embrace and become champion to move the agenda of the scale-up forward, the scale-up started, and the recommendation was for countries to provide services to men 15 to 49 years old. Then we started looking at the data, and we realized that in most countries, the population that was actually taking advantage of the service that was offered was mainly the 10 to 14 years old. And the 25 years old and above was actually not receptive to the messages and was actually not seeking for services. So this triggered a series of new discussions. And some stakeholders thought that, okay, since the program was designed for the 15 to 49, and we only see the 10 to 14, maybe the policy should be very clear, and then state clearly that the minimum age to access services should be age 15. Other stakeholders thought that, no, there's probably a reason why the 10 to 14 are embracing the intervention more than other age groups. Let's try to understand that and before we can make some decisions. And there were other stakeholders who were like, well, in countries, we actually need to pay attention to the cultural aspect, which clearly shows that the age at which men accept and get culturally circumcised is the age 10 to 14. Some other voice were also have some concern by saying, well, when someone is actually circumcised at age 10 and is not yet sexually active, that person will not really contribute in averting HIV infection in the next 2 to 3 years. So several questions came as a result of all of that. And it then triggered us to say, okay, we need to be able to answer those new questions so that we can be able to make some decisions to move to help the program re-strategize in terms of age prioritization, in terms of geographic prioritization.
Thanks. And the questions, if I remember correctly, that the modeling was answering were about the impact and cost effectiveness of circumcising different age groups of men, and then also by subnational geography. Was there anything else that the model was intended to answer?
Yes. So the first model actually was looking at all the questions with only one age group, the age group 15 to 14, 49, I think so, 49 or 44. And it was definitely not possible for us to be able to understand the importance of each of the age groups in the cost savings, but also in the contributing in infection averted. So that's why we decided to then, first we wanted to modify the DMPPT1, but then we realized that the DMPPT1 modified will definitely not be able to answer those questions. So we then decided to just develop a new model that we then be able to look at all of the questions of interest by taking each of the age groups separately. Because the DMPPT1 was a brand that was already very well recognized within the VMMC community, we just decided to call the new model DMPPT2. So that people can see that there's a continuity. But the DMPPT2 was not really some kind of second version of DMPPT1. It was a different model altogether. So again, that also shows that even the brand that we use for a model is important to carefully think about that. If we would have come up with a different name, we will not have used the credibility that the DMPPT1 already had to be able to sell the DMPPT2. So, you are right, Catherine. The DMPPT2 came, but we also wanted to do much more than just answering those questions, and the DMPPT2 actually moved to be a model that was able to answer those questions, but also became some kind of monitoring tool that was used further by countries moving forward to actually monitor the progress in achieving the various objectives that each country was setting themselves. For the DMPPT2, we also decided to take a different approach and methodology. DMPPT1, we did a top-down desk review using readily available data, and the countries received the result of the desk review from the global level with not that many involvement for them to actually be able to make decisions. With the DMPPT2, we actually decided to take a bottom-up approach where each country actually received technical support to do a full country exercise. And for each of the country exercise, these countries were able to then make decisions on their own about their questions of interest, about the data that they want to be used, about the assumption that they want the modelers to use, and they were fully empowered to actually make decisions all the way to the final result of the data. And each country exercise was published in PLOS One, making the exercise result becoming also evidence for the country. Each of those country exercises have influenced a lot for those countries to then make some strategic decisions on the direction that they wanted to take for the scale-up of VMMC, which was really what we were envisioning by taking that bottom-up approach, by taking the strategic planning at the country level and make it much more focused and much more effective, and by going down to the level as low as the district level.
And what were some of the ways, Emmanuel, of that this DMPPT2 modeling exercise actually influenced strategic planning and implementation in countries? What were some of the decisions that were taken as a result of this modeling?
I think this is a question we probably can make a long list of those decisions. Because the scale-up of VMMC was no longer the same after each country finished their country exercise. We moved from a country having a blanket target to say we need to circumcise X number of men in 5 years, age 15 to 49. To countries having a huge amount of data, understanding the potential impact of the age group 10 to 14, 15 to 19, 20 to 24, and so on. And some countries then understood that, wait a minute, we actually might spend a lot of resources trying to reach out to men above 30 years old, yet they are actually not contributing that much of the potential HIV infection because the size of that population is not as big as the size of the population of the 10 to 14 who are going to age 15 to 19 in just between 1 to 5 years old, 1 to 5 years coming down the road. So I think people started to appreciate the power of some parameters like the aging, like the movement of the population, like the size of the population, of those subpopulations, in actually understanding the impact of each of those age groups in the overall potential impact of VMMC to avert HIV infection. So it changed completely the way stakeholders understood the importance of each of those age groups. So countries then moved from the blanket age group 15 to 49 to say, well, I think for us, we want to focus on the age group 15 to 29 or 10 to 29, depending on the countries. So there was a lot of decisions, a lot of critical decisions that was made as a result of all of those country exercise. Decisions related to age prioritization. There were several perspectives. So those decisions were sometimes in line depending on the perspective, sometimes a little bit of difference depending on the perspective. A lot of decisions related to geographic prioritization. A lot of confirmation also of what actually the previous program was already doing well, particularly on geographic prioritization. The modeling actually came to confirm that the intervention from the beginning was very well planned in terms of geographic prioritization. But it did help some countries to be much more specific and much more precise when it comes to geographic prioritization of use of resources. It gave some good information to implementing partners, particularly for demand creation. It provided also some useful information to donors, to WHO and UNAIDS, as WHO and UNAIDS was already thinking about the next steps after the end of the first 5 years of the phase of the Joint Strategic Action Framework to scale up VMMC in Eastern and Southern Africa. So the DMPPT2, I don't know, we can to really have the long list of decisions of influence that the model had on the program, we probably need to do it country by country, but the list is very huge.
Thank you. And would you say that the DMPPT2 modeling was used in advocacy? And if so, how was it used in advocacy?
Yes, and first of all, when we first talked about this developing the DMPPT2, advocacy was our primary objective. And then when the model was developed, and when the data was keep coming, we then realized the additional potential of the model. We moved to even use the model as a monitoring tool, which is not often done. And the model was also put online for several stakeholders to be able to access and use the model on their own. And we try to make it as user-friendly as possible, but the primary objective of what we are intending to achieve was advocacy. We were trying to solve the discussions among stakeholders related to the age prioritization for VMMC scale-up.
Yeah, and just to summarize what you had said before in terms of the key messages out of the modeling, I think you mentioned one of the key messages was that the impact of circumcising men over age 30 in most cases was not really substantial. And so that freed up resources for countries to put more more efforts towards circumcising the younger men where it was more culturally acceptable. And then another key message was about the impact and cost effectiveness of circumcising the 10 to 14 year olds. Were there any other key messages that you wanted to highlight?
Some of the key messages, we started to provide coverage of circumcision coverage every year to countries. We also started to provide infection averted every year also to countries. We were able to look at the coverage by age group and by subnational unit, which was very useful for implementation, for implementing partners. Those are some of the key messages coming from that exercise.
Thank you. What would you say worked really well with the DMPPT2 modeling?
I think the bottom-up approach was very well. It definitely addressed some of the few concerns some stakeholders had from the DMPPT1 exercise. We were criticized mainly on the DMPPT1 exercise because it was a desk review. It was a top-down approach. The DMPPT2 actually addressed that very well and gave some level of authority to the stakeholders at country level for them to actually make decisions about the scale-up of their own program.
Sorry, I went back on mute for a second. What were the challenges or issues that you saw in the VMMC advocacy efforts using this modeling data?
The key challenge was for stakeholders to accept that countries need to make their own decision. Contrary to the DMPPT1, where everyone was in the same room, and the big elephant in the room was the global community, the country's voice was not really loud. In the DMPPT2, the country's voice was louder. But then we did not have the same harmony among everyone, global and country, to be able to accept the decision that was made country by country. Each country also made different decisions. So there was not that single simple blanket messages that can be used across all 14 countries anymore. You are then making the messaging much more complex and complicated. And I think the advocacy definitely suffer from that. So it was a balance whether we stick to commit to countries to make their own decision, or we then have that overall global community making decision for the country. So it's a trade-in that need to be weighed in when someone do actually this kind of exercise, and someone really need to know exactly what he's trying to achieve.
Great. So that's the end of our questions. Was there anything else you wanted to add to your reflections on this discussion?
Well, one thing that I want to add is that I've observed that there's a mix of feelings when it comes to use of modeling to provide data that can be used for decision making. Lot of people consider that we need to do a randomized controlled trial or a research or a much another type of research methodology in order to have an evidence. Unfortunately, not all questions can be answered by a randomized controlled trial. And modeling can actually provide answer to some questions. Modeling have limitations, definitely. And what I have observed is that the challenge when we do modeling exercise come to the strategy on how we engage with stakeholders. So what I have learned through all these years of doing advocacy is that stakeholder engagement is something that should be taken seriously, and that should be planned very carefully. Identification of the stakeholder, analysis of how we will engage each of them, understanding of the interest of each of those stakeholders, and identification of really how we should engage every single of them. So this is something that if someone pay attention, it will definitely add a value to the scientific work of developing the model and actually doing the actual analysis and come up with the result.
That's great. Thank you so much. Nadia, was there anything you wanted to add?
No, I've taken some detailed notes and we'll review the recording as well, but I think that the answers that you gave and the way that you spoke about the models, Dr. Emmanuel, was really excellent. You've given us some really great things to prioritize in our case study, including the role of the stakeholder. And I think that this will be a great case study for people to listen to.
Yeah, I think our audience is going to love this, Emmanuel. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you.
We really appreciate your time.
It would be great to see how the course looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely send you the final version. I'm going to try to do some editing on the recording, but the way that you spoke as well was, it presents to a very, very readable approach as well. So I think we'll try like a twofold approach. So thank you again for taking the time to speak with us.
And Emmanuel, once this course is released, anyone can take it and it's free. So if you know of people that might be interested, you know, you're welcome to pass the link on to them once we send it to you.
Definitely. I think some of my actual clients, definitely they need to take such course.
Yeah. That's great.
All right. Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Emmanuel.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.